How many of you are new to the whole concept of accessibility? This is your maiden voyage. Nobody. Good. How many of you know nothing about me? Do I have to give you the story of how I got started in accessibility on the dark and stormy night 25 years ago? I can if you want. It's actually not a bad story, especially for British, because I'm Canadian, right? So I can give you some like old cute Canadian background. Okay, hands up. Who wants to hear the story? All right, fine. Here we go. Right. It was a dark and stormy night. It was roughly 1974, 1975, and I was 14 or 15 years old in my hometown, which is Moncton, New Brunswick. New Brunswick is the Canadian province between Quebec and Nova Scotia, north of the state of Maine. It's in the Maritimes. So I was sitting up in my pajamas in front of the television set, manually changing channels. Remember when you had to sit in front of the television and manually change channels? Yeah, well, that's what I did. And I bumped into what was obviously the ABC, American ABC newscast with a reduced version of what the newscaster was saying written on the screen. So I could not figure this out at all. I watched till the end of the show. I couldn't figure it out. I came back the next night. I still couldn't figure it out. Several days later, I was able to glean from the openings and the other parts of the program that this was a show called The Captioned ABC News. Back in the 70s, a public television station in Boston had a license from ABC to record their evening newscast, transcribe it, edit the transcription down because at that time we thought that those poor deaf people couldn't handle real English, and then impose the captions on the screen so they were open captions that everyone saw, and then retransmit that program 5 hours later at 11:30 or, in my time zone, 12:30 a.m. So for several years, on most school nights, I was up till 1 in the morning watching this show from 12:30 to 1 because there were no VCRs back then, you see. Speaking of 21st century technologies, I happen to have a manual typewriter, which conveniently camouflaged my age. So I was able to write a letter to the public television station that produced the captioned ABC News, and I had two questions for them. What system do you use to put the captions on the show? And why is the W taller than all of the other lowercase letters, and why are your quotation marks just two dots? And from those humble beginnings, 25 years ago, did an empire begin. In all that time, I've kept up with the field. I've volunteered in the accessibility business. I worked for a government ministry in something related to disability. I've done a lot of work on web accessibility and topics like captioning and audio description for cinema and television. You have advanced speaking notes on the CD. If you go to joeclark.org/CW, don't bother right now. There's nothing there. You'll get a 404. When I get home, there will be an entire set of speaking notes with all the code samples that we require from what we learned today, links to all the things we talked about, and just in general, the notes from the presentation, which is what I do after all my presentations. So keep that in mind when you get back. It won't be till late next week, but do check in, joeclark.org/CW for Carson Workshop. These are my Edward Tufte Memorial slides. This is another one of my little catchphrases. If you were a blind or visually impaired person in the room, some of you might be, you really wouldn't be missing anything if you couldn't see my slides. I'm sort of anti-PowerPoint. I think, you know, PowerPoint corrupts. So, of course, does the information architect named Edward Tufte, who's a bit overblown, but he's right about some things. So I have super minimalist visuals, and don't be afraid of that. It's all about ideas and talking. However, we can do code samples, and I've set up my computer here so that we can do that. So we can type right on screen if you'd like later. I'm also not going to stick to too much of a script this morning. I have a plan. I have, you know, a lesson plan. But we're going to deal with whatever you need because the title of the presentation is Sharing the Secrets of Web Accessibility, and I don't know what you think is secret. So you can come back to me at any time. I made some educated guesses on what you need to learn. And I did the same thing with planning for the content for the CD, which is why you are the only people who have error-corrected text of my book, Building Accessible Websites. I went through all the errata that had been reported and implemented all of them. So if you go on the website, joeclark.org/book, you'll find the text of the book that is frankly littered with mistakes even after Herculean efforts to remove the mistakes. In this case, you have the copy that's been completely corrected of all known typos, small mistakes in code, that sort of thing. What I didn't change in the book is the outdated advice. So, for example, the half chapter on using tables for layout if you really have to, I didn't remove. All the things that we've learned are no longer really the right ways to do things. I left in the book for historical reasons. So some future generation or some alien race or some evolved dolphins or whoever comes and takes over the planet Earth can look back to the year 2002 and see what sort of primitive things people were writing about web accessibility. I've opted to retain that, but all the typos and so on have been fixed. You can, in fact, ask questions more or less any time. Just try not to interrupt me in the middle of a syllable. If I can't answer them right then and there, jot them down, and then I'll take them home as a homework assignment. We'll put them up on the website later. And actually, a question about the code writing, which I mentioned before. How much of that would you like to do? None, some, all? Is there any opinion on that? Feel free to just speak. And everyone shrugs. Guy here says some. Some. All right. That'll be fine. Why be accessible is an easy question for all of you to answer. Here's my notes on the why be accessible section. It's two lines of 18-point type. You know this already, because you can, because it's correct, and because in many cases you're legally required to do it. There. Since you're all experts, I don't have to go through the song and dance on why to be accessible. You know that already. But something you may not be aware of are the true statistics of people with disabilities in the United Kingdom. I looked up the actual numbers from the Office for National Statistics. We're all aware of lobby groups that like to inflate the numbers of people who have a certain disability. I don't see the purpose of this. Whether there are 30,000 people with a disability or 3 million people with a disability, how does that have any bearing on things? It's important to look at impartial statistics, which are the government ones. The most recent disability figures they published are from 2001. And here you have to be careful to look at disabilities that are related to web usage. Over 11% of the UK population has such a disability, one that is relevant to usage of the web, or 808,000 people. 3.6% of the UK population have a sensory disability. That means difficulty in seeing or difficulty in hearing. Additionally, some of the people with a mobility impairment, 5.7% of the population, which is 404,000 people, will be affected by web accessibility. And here, those numbers that I'm talking about refer to musculoskeletal problems of the arms or hands. So people with mobility impairments that refer to, say, walking or wheelchair users, in many cases, are excluded from that number. Also, some people with a learning disability, 2.1% or 149,000 people, will be served by web accessibility. If you put all that together, that's many hundreds of thousands of people. Again, it wouldn't necessarily matter if it were millions or tens of thousands. The whole point is we're doing this to serve minority groups. We do know that studies from the United States show that people with some disabilities have different participation rates than non-disabled people. That is, they use the internet less often, right? It's fair to assume that's true everywhere in the world. But the problem, of course, here is that until the statistics start asking specific questions about computer and internet usage, we have to guess. We have to infer that a lot of people with blindness or visual impairment have difficulty using the web because the census doesn't actually ask them questions about that. We have to infer that a large number of those people might have web accessibility issues. But when we get to other disabilities like hearing impairment, the question is, how much trouble does that group have using the web? We don't know because we don't have specific questions in the census. Since we're talking about these minority groups, though, we have to look at the whole picture. If you add them all up, it's a large population. But keep in mind that we're not engaged in the practice of making websites just for blind people. Our goal in web accessibility is to make the web accessible to people with disabilities, not just people who are visually impaired. It will always be possible to find a person who, despite our best efforts, even if we go to the absolute max of knowledge of web accessibility, still can't use our site. There are always people with disabilities who can't use accessible services. In architecture, that's certainly an example. Even if you have a brand new building with automatic doors all over the place, and many other features for disabled occupants, there might still be someone who couldn't use your building. It's the same with a website. Nonetheless, that should not prevent us from doing things to the maximum we can. And when we're alerted to the needs of someone with this kind of exceptional disability, we can see what we can do after that. The interesting thing about the progression of web accessibility is that we now know enough things to serve not just very big groups like blind people, but subgroups within those populations, like some people with low vision. Guidelines. Well, you all probably know about WCAG, right? Am I the only one in the group who pronounces it WCAG? Do the rest of you pronounce it WCAG? Or do the rest of you say WCAG? Or do you, when you read the word, do you not hear a word in your mind? Do you not have a sound at all? You see this little glyph that has four letters in it, right? Well, we're not in the U.S. We're not working for their federal government, so the Section 508 rules don't apply. We're not in Germany, so their BitV rules don't apply. And we're not just dealing with blind people, so the RNIB's advice is not gospel either. That leaves us with the only credible international accessibility guidelines, which are the Web Content Accessibility Guidelines, WCAG or WCAG. They were published in 1999, which is an era almost before living memory for most of us, and a lot of rust is showing through on the old girl. WCAG 2.0 will not possibly be done this year, no matter what they say. I asked the WCAG working group for a timeline, their known timeline of when they think everything will go through their process, and they couldn't produce one. They don't even have a timeline for completion. They won't for two more weeks. Another issue, of course, is that WCAG 2.0 might end up being so unrealistic you won't want to use it. There's a bit of a super exclusive scoop for Carson Workshop attendees. If you check my homepage, it says I'm an invited expert with the Web Content Accessibility Guidelines Working Group. These are the people who work on WCAG 2. Well, not anymore. Two nights ago, after midnight, I got an email from one of the co-chairs essentially asking me to take a loyalty oath and start being extra nice to the people on the WCAG working group. And if I didn't tell them I'd do that by last night, well, apparently I'm out. So as of today, several things are happening today. One, you're all paying good money to come and see me speak because you think I'm valuable in the field of web accessibility. There's a site called itgazette.com that has an interview with me that they've just published today, subscribers only, I'm afraid. And simultaneously today, I've essentially become exiled from the WCAG working group. So this could be a very interesting day in my career for web accessibility. All I can say is I want to thank you all for having this vote of confidence in me, but the WCAG working group doesn't share it. Okay, and all you live bloggers, please put that on right away. Okay, so WCAG 2 isn't coming along. We're stuck with WCAG 1. But in those 6 years, we've had a long time to figure out the right and wrong ways of doing things. We've developed a lot of rules of thumb on how to implement the WCAG intelligently, and I'm hoping to put them all in one place for you here today. Not just WCAG is something we have to worry, but of course we have legislation. You're in the United Kingdom, and the Disability Discrimination Act does indeed mandate web accessibility for services offered to the public in its code of practice. The Disability Rights Commission publishes its code of practice in an inaccessible, untagged PDF. Nonetheless, you can Google the URL and it will turn it into HTML for you, and you can struggle through it. It is not in dispute that public websites that provide a service to the public have to be accessible under the Disability Discrimination Act. You in the United Kingdom are very lucky to have such unambiguous legislation. That doesn't mean people are following it, and that doesn't mean that companies that aren't following it are being prosecuted. Those are two separate discussions. Nonetheless, it's plain as the nose on my face that you have to comply if you have public websites that provide a service. In the fullness of time, we may get a British standard for accessibility, a Made in Britain standard for access, which will be just one more thing to get us confused by, but it could actually end up being better than WCAG. While we're waiting for that to happen, the best course of action is to intelligently apply WCAG and do user tests whenever possible. But the issue here is, even though you may be legally required to do it, I want you to like to do it. I want you to enjoy it, right? The kind of people who tend to enjoy this thing are the sort of thing are detail-oriented people, because web accessibility is all about details. Many of them picayune. So if you're detail-oriented, this is right up your alley. If you're more of a generalist or a manager, this sort of thing will probably cause your eyes to glaze over. But I expect that most of you here today are the kind of people who are predisposed to liking this sort of thing. And I hope at the end of the day you'll leave the place and go to the bar and get rad-arsed with the rest of us, but feeling really stoked on the whole concept of accessibility and liking it even more. All right, accessibility and web standards. How many people in this room do not know what web standards are? Nil. Good. would anyone in the audience, and this is our first audience participation, Ryan, would anyone in the audience like to venture a definition of web standards? Just make it up off the cuff. No live bloggers. Just we know you know. So someone else, anyone feel like doing that? Don't all put your hands up at once. Man over there, producing code that validates against the standard, is what he said. That's a reasonable working definition. Thanks for playing. Further to that, you all know what valid HTML means. You know, all know what valid code means. Am I not correct? All right. This, by the way, puts you in the elite 0.1% of all web developers on the planet. Similarly, you all know what semantic HTML is, correct? Is there anyone who doesn't? That means, of course, selecting HTML attributes and elements according to the intended meaning of the content you're marking up. All right, so you all know that, which this means you have expertise. Then you probably are also aware that accessibility is a subset of web standards. You get a lot of accessibility for free if you have a standards-compliant markup. The most obvious example is, of course, alt texts. The HTML and XHTML specs require you to put an alternate text on images and a couple of other elements. You can't have valid code without it. So if you're complying with web standards and having nice valid HTML, you will have that part of accessibility covered. Now, here's another question for you. This one will, I'm sure, strike close to home for a lot of you. How many of you are stuck wrangling, fighting all day, really, with content management systems that produce really bad code? That's a lot, yeah. Come back and give us a bit more information here. In years, how old are some of those content management systems?
Six.
Four. Right. Can you remember what you were doing on the web 6 or 4 years ago? Okay. In the back, she can. All right. You've got a better memory than most of us, right? Look, I've been online since 1991, and I can't tell you what I was doing in 1999 when WCAG came out. So, I mean, you have this whole problem, right? A subset of the previous problem. How many of you have to deal with Microsoft Word output for HTML? Four or five people, yeah. And, you know, that's a lovely way to start your day, isn't it? Especially on a Monday morning. So, if you're using these outdated systems, that has an implication for web standards and accessibility, because even though there are some technologies that don't have a concept of validity, like JavaScript, there are some technologies that are more prevalent, like HTML and CSS, that do. If you're using these outdated content management systems or Microsoft Word or something else that's spitting out really bad code, well, you can spend all day trying to clean it up, or you can just live with it and publish it with invalid code. Is that really a problem? Well, as far as I'm concerned, there are only two cases where it's a serious problem, where invalidity is a serious problem. I will qualify that statement in a minute, so don't everyone get excited quite yet. But the two big cases where invalid content has an implication for accessibility are our old friend Tag Soup. I had to sit there. Actually, when I was doing this slide, I had to sit there for several minutes and try to figure out how to write a set of Tag Soup. This is not real. I had to fake this, and I had to sit there and think about it. So such is the indoctrination of web standards, right? So I have here font in uppercase, family equals Arial, everyone's favorite typeface, a span, a P with a style on it that isn't closed correctly, but it's missing its final quotation mark. Oh, and I'm using PX fonts for extra flavor. I close the font tag too early. I have a big B for bold, and then I start typing some text. Even though I faked that, that's pretty good as far as Tag Soup goes. What is the accessibility implication here? It's just that the browser cannot figure out what you mean. The browser has to guess what you mean. Every browser guesses differently. To be more accurate, every rendering engine guesses differently. Like the Gecko engine in Mozilla, Opera's rendering engine, WebKit on Safari, Trident on the Internet Explorer platform, Tasman on the other Internet Explorer platform, they all will guess differently. If you have serious Tag Soup, the browser can't figure out what you mean by the document. And since adaptive technologies sit on top of browsers and interact with them, they have to struggle through it too. It's an unnecessary problem. When you have incorrectly nested elements, especially if they're things that are quasi-structural, for example, if you're incorrectly nesting headings or images or links, you still find, to this day, you still find half a page that turns into a link because they didn't close their A, right? Or lists. Then you, if you're using an adaptive technology, you simply can't make head or tail of that document. Another implication of TagSoup, of course, is that it will produce all sorts of images, including spacer GIFs, without alt texts. So if you're sitting there listening to it in a screen reader, not only will you not have any idea of the structure of the document, but you'll have to listen to a lot of extraneous information from incorrectly rendered images. And the second case of invalid content is our troublesome friend embed. How many of you have to put out multimedia on your pages? And I mean video or audio. 4 or 5 or 6, right? I'm all in favor of that. Let's have more of that, right? It's fine. Even Flash, like, go for it, right? The problem is the standards compliant way of doing this, which is object, simply doesn't work here in the real world. You all know why, I'm sure. Internet Explorer on Windows is the one that falls down most spectacularly on this. So if you want your multimedia, your audio, or video on your page to actually work, you have no choice but to use embed. And I don't care anymore. I give up. What I'm saying is embed has won. Like, I don't care. I would just prefer to be ashamed, you know? I'll just have that as a blot on my record. If you have a non-TagSoup page, if you've done other things correctly, if you're using, you know, semantic HTML with headings and lists and the whole nine yards, and the only way you can get your multimedia to work is embed, and that's really the only big thing that's wrong if you run it through the validator, or if that's the only thing that's wrong if you run it through the validator, I don't care anymore, because it will function with the existing adaptive technologies. It will work for other people with disabilities. It will actually work in the browser for all your visitors. It's a bit pie in the sky to insist on the object element, which just doesn't work in the real world, compared to this thing, which doesn't. And of course, if you want to be really keen, you can define your own XHTML document type to make embed legal. There's nothing wrong with that. Please feel free to go ahead. I have a whole page up on my site of ways to do that. But I'm thinking that as we bring 2005 to a close, we just have to accept that we live in an imperfect world and that embed will have to do for now. Perhaps in 2008, we can come back and have another discussion about this and look back with embarrassment, and have a little chuckle about what we were forced to do in the earlier ages. Now, it's still important to avoid TagSoup. I mean, that's of paramount importance, actually. If you're mandated to reach WCAG Priority 2, which requires valid code, then you're going to have a problem. That's level double A. One of our deficiencies of WCAG is that's two names for everything, Priority 2 and level double A. If your content manager system only puts this sort of thing out and you have to meet Priority 2, well, you either don't meet it, or you spend all day fixing the errors of the content management system. Another cause of concern is if you have a public site that permits comments, and the comments can include HTML or other things. If you have a perfectly valid page and someone starts putting site comments on it, if they screw it up, well, the whole page becomes invalid. It's an all-or-nothing proposition. I don't have a solution for that problem. This is a content management issue that my dear friends in the Authoring Tools Accessibility Guidelines Working Group were trying valiantly to work on, and I pretty much failed. I don't have an answer. I do have an interim solution, which I'd like to discuss with you during this or during the break, as you'd like. It's possible to meet all of the Priority 1 guidelines and all of the Priority 2s except valid code. The way things work in WCAG 1, you can't claim compliance with Priority 2 unless you meet all of them. One thing you can do is to use semantic HTML and have only a couple of validity mistakes, things like embed, and meet everything else in Priority 2, but just not certify that you meet Priority 2. If you're legally or organizationally mandated to do it, then this little dodge that I've just described does not work. But if you're running your own shop or something, and you know that your content management system cannot preserve this fragile concept of valid code indefinitely, then you can try what I've just suggested. Do everything else but the valid code part of priority 2. Claim you meet only priority 1 and most of priority 2. And then hope for the best. Hope for another product to come along that will solve your problem later. How is that actually better than not doing anything at all or just only working on the priority 1 guidelines? Well, it begins to be a semantic issue. It begins to be a matter of semantics, to use another sense of the word. If you're 95% of the way there to valid code, even if you have a big page with 25 errors on it, but they're not tag soup, it's just that people have put in images with no alt text or this sort of thing, and you're using semantic HTML otherwise, and you meet all the other guidelines for things like image markup, lists, links, this link text, this sort of thing, well, you are already more accessible than 95% of the websites out there. It is a pragmatic limitation that you're stuck with to have everything but valid code on the page. One possible advantage of WCAG 2 when it comes out is that you'll be able to claim compliance with only sections of it, although you may not be able to get away with the dodge I've just described. That is an approach that I'm essentially suggesting you adopt here. Another thing you could try for me, this is a request from your presenter. Give it a whirl on a real site sometime. It could just be your personal website running a really bad content management system like Movable Type or something that can't really produce valid code. And see if meeting everything else but the validity requirement and stating such actually works for you, so we can get a bit more experience on that. So I've just actually proposed a radical solution that seems to be at odds with everything else I've stood for my entire life. It's like I'm, renouncing my past or something, but I think it's like dealing with embed. It's the only thing we can do in pragmatic terms. Any comments on that? Anyone like to call me a heretic? Please go ahead. Woman in the back would like to call me a heretic?
Well, I'm one as well, so I really applaud that pragmatic approach, Joe, because I think that, like, validation has become the new Bobby, and people...
TM.
Yeah.
Write that down. Validation has become the new Bobby, TM.
It's like people run things through validators looking for flaws in the page when they don't actually know the issues behind it. And, I think that you said it really succinctly, that the real world issues like semantics are much more important, and the validation should just come in the back. Of course, we should all aim towards it, but it isn't the be-all and end-all.
No problem. I have a luxury on my own sites. And as I was mentioning to this nice gentleman before, if you look at my sites and you think they're defective in some way, like, for example, they look like complete shite, or they're rather outdated things, they look like they come from 1991, right? Everything that you think is deficient about my sites is because I don't know how to fix it, even though I literally know everyone in the world who has the highest possible knowledge and they could help me, right? But I'm trying to learn things myself. I have my own limitations. But I'm fortunate enough that I can write my own HTML by hand if I have to, and I use WordPress, which is a highly compliant system. So I can meet priority 2 all the time. Interestingly, I found an old page of mine from 1995 or 1996 that had invalid code in it, and I had forgotten I'd ever written it. I'm just leaving it up. I'm leaving it up so I'll have something to refer to. Like, this is such a curiosity now, a page of mine that doesn't have valid code. But since I'm an elite developer, despite my deficiencies, I can handle my own code. A lot of you can't, because you work in organizations whose managers were snowed by the marketing and bought some other terrible system at £100,000 per year that can't produce that. So unfortunately, we have to live in a pragmatic world. Go out of your way, though, to reprogram that system so it produces semantic HTML. I want headings, I want lists, I want paragraphs, I want the whole nine yards. That I insist on. Go to all sorts of trouble on that. But if you can't get it to spit out valid code and the producer of the system doesn't want to upgrade it to make that possible, don't fight City Hall. Work on things you can work on. All right. Now, on the schedule, we had a segment of how to take a tag soup document, identify its HTML structure, and then mark them up with document semantics. I'm guessing you all know how to do that. Is that a fair thing to say? And almost everyone nods. We can still do that, of course. It's on the sched. Would anyone like to do that, or is that superfluous at this point in our economic history?
Is it an interesting document?
Well,
there could be more than one solution. We can argue over, is it a definition list, or is it an unordered list?
Yes, yes, we could do that. Life is, however, a bit too short. We've all done things we're not completely proud of when it comes to document semantics. However, there are times when we have to approximate. As we all know, HTML is an old standard, which was not put together by the most worldly people in the world in our experience, and it misses a lot of things that we really really need. Right, the fact that we're having discussions over strong M, B, and I suggests that we actually need five or six more things to actually encompass the real world. We need an element just for names of ships, because those are usually italicized, this sort of thing, right? Whenever you have to make a command decision, like James T. Kirk on deciding to set the destruct sequence, well, that's fine. You've had to make a command decision. Don't spend too much time on it. Whether it's an ordered list or an unordered list or a definition list or just a bunch of links with commas between them and a period at the end, pick something and live with it. I don't go back and do markovers of my own pages. If you look at things I did in the year 2000 or so on, they're actually quite awful. And that includes a lot of my accessibility pages. It runs through the validator, they're perfectly accessible pages, but as far as document semantics goes, they're not as good as I'd like them to be now. Them's the breaks. We all grow up, right? Pick something that seems to be the most immediately obvious option, and then get on with your day. By the way, the next time you see me posting on someone's site saying, well, that should have been a definition list instead of an unordered list, then assume that it's the end of the day and I'm just doing that recreationally. I don't actually mean that, that's billable time I'm spending on that. All right. So we're not going to spot semantics, but we are going to talk about layouts. In the book, I had an entire half chapter on table layouts and how to make them less bad. And I shouldn't have given them the time of day, even in 2002, when I was writing it, I shouldn't have given them the time of day. This was rather foolish of me. Time has marched on. However, is anyone in the audience forced to use a table-based layout for one reason or another? Oh, good. This I want to hear. Okay, so tell us why, Ryan. Let's get a go here. Who wants to go first?
I guess it's because our designers have come up with table-based layouts and we haven't really got the time to stick it all into CSS, even though that's what we'd really like to do.
And is that working on a content management system? In other words, it's embedded in a template that is very difficult to fix?
It's not very difficult to fix, no.
Time-consuming?
It's a time sort of issue, really, more than anything.
Do you have the capacity to change, for example, just the home page?
Possibly. We've got a lot of demands. So.
But you have another things.
Yeah.
Okay, next. Who else is in this terrible, terrible state? Wasn't it you, that this young man here?
Because it makes too much money.
Ka-ching.
They won't let us fix it.
Please feel free to elaborate on that.
Okay. I work for Yahoo, and the UK, all of Europe, front page has two versions. One is CSS-based, and one is tables-based.
Mm-hmm.
And we are not allowed to ditch the tables-based version.
Do they not look and act the same?
Yes. Well, as much as we can make them act the same.
I know people at Yahoo San Francisco, and they struggle with this. At South by Southwest in Austin, we're all standing around at the bar, and I had all of them there, and I asked them, when will any part of any page of Yahoo ever have valid code? And all of them simultaneously sucked air, like the Japanese. They all went like that. All of them at once. And the guy who's tasked with this looked very embarrassed and said, we know about that. We can't fix it. But all our login pages are almost completely valid code now. So, yeah, the Yahoo people know about this. And they're, as you are probably aware, they're trying to do more things with open formats, especially for video. And ultimately, they'll reach a point at which they can't do open formats for video while having tag soup layouts. And that will be a day of reckoning. I believe there's another person who has stuck with this lady here.
Walked into a job and inherited a lot of sites that have been done by a design agency. So they're used to paper, so tables are comfortable for them. So I've just inherited about 20 little mini sites. They're all tables. Hmm. And I'm stuck with them because everybody likes them that way, and I don't have time to now go and redo the whole site, 20 of them.
And for the for the two of the three of you, not the one we're saddled with Yahoo's money issue. Do you have the capacity to make new sites in CSS?
Yeah.
How about you? Sort of. The guy in the back is shrugging. Sort of. Sort of has the capacity to do that. Well, that's fine. Very infrequently, you'll run across an occasion where the only way to make something work is a table. I had a client. By the way, I couldn't solve this. I had them call Dan Cederholm, and I don't think he can solve it either. They had to have a footer on the bottom of only two columns of three on a page, and the data was coming from three or four different databases simultaneously. So those two columns could have be of any arbitrary length, and the footer was also coming from a database and could have different sizes. And they could not figure out a way to do that apart from tables. So this is a financial site. Patrick Lauka is frowning. So this is a financial site. It was legal, I think. It was a legal footer. So they had to put that in there, and they couldn't figure out a way to do it apart from tables. Now, of course, that same page also used frames, and there was no way they could get away from the frames either. So this is kind of a worst-case scenario. So there are these, if you imagine the bell curve, at the far left, right, when the curve asymptotes almost to the x-axis, there are these one or two cases where it's still necessary. And there are times when you have no choice, you just don't have time, which you can never get back to fix it, and that's fine. We live with that. But in the future, we have to use CSS for layout, which is a somewhat difficult and challenging thing for a lot of people. My mind just doesn't wrap around it very well, which explains why my sites look the way they do. But there's a lot of help out there, and it's a pretty easy thing. We do, however, have some issues in using CSS layouts when it comes to accessibility. The big one, of course, is presentation order versus source code order. So now we're going to do a swap. Now the fun begins, ladies and gentlemen. Actually, I'm going to use this site for a couple of things. It's theglobeandmail.com. All right, let's see if it works. Very good. Okay, so this is the Globe and Mail newspaper in Toronto. Interestingly, my friend Craig Sala, you may know that name, works at the Globe and Mail and struggles valiantly within constraints. This is multiple tables. You wouldn't believe how many tables are in this. However, he's doing quasi-standards compliant things like that is, in fact, the typeface known as Walbaum, which is they have a custom version of Walbaum and they're using it, and they're using Cipher, the Sean Inman flash replacement. And this is a correctly marked up heading. He uses ordered lists for other things. To the extent possible, he's using document semantics inside a tag soup table-based layout. He also has a font resizer, which we'll talk about in a minute. But the concept of presentation order, what is the first thing to look at on this page? I guess it's that headline, New Orleans Police Ordered to Stop Looter, or just globeandmail.ca, as you wish. If you're coming into this news item for the first time, probably the first thing you want to read is the headline and then the rest of the copy. You would probably ignore the giant header at the top with its search field. You'll try to ignore the animated advertisement in the middle of the page. You may look at the photograph of the flood-ravaged city on the right. All right, that's great. That's the first time you go and look at it. What happens if you've read the thing and you want to search for more articles on the New Orleans flood? Then all of a sudden you probably want to go back to the top of the page and attempt to find the search field. So on your second run through of the site, your focus has changed. You're now trying to find the search. What if you wanted to actually look at the... You remember seeing that there's a photo gallery somewhere on the page. Well, what if you want to find that? You may have to use the find command in your browser to locate this tiny photo gallery link down here. So on your third run through of this page, which could all be in the span of 2 or 3 minutes, you're looking for something else. And this is actually, this is a more abstract example, a typical example of a site like Yahoo, for example. You never know exactly where the visitor is going to want to put their attention on from one visit to another. So one of the other deficiencies of HTML is we don't have a way of indicating important sections. We don't have a way of indicating headline, body copy, subheads, dex, leads, photos, photo captions. We do not have structures for those things. We have to mark them up approximately. So if you're a machine, if you're an adaptive technology, or if you're just a browser interpreting CSS, You have no way to know what's really important. It's up to the human being to decide what's important, right? And that is something that's difficult, bordering on impossible, to specify in a machine-readable format. So if, let's say you're a screen reader, let's say you're a really good screen reader, and you come into this page, well, if you were interpreting this layout correctly, let's imagine it were CSS, wouldn't you want to read the headline first? But how can it find the headline? It doesn't really know what that is, apart from just guessing that an H1 might be a headline. So it's understandable, I think, that screen readers would have a hard time figuring out what the most important thing to read on the page is. And we have user testing, actually, that shows that they don't. It shows that even though there's supposed to be some CSS awareness on the part of the screen readers, because they sit on top of the browser, usually Internet Explorer on Windows, in fact, they just read the source code order. They just read your HTML from top to bottom. This is a somewhat shocking realization, especially given the prices that people have to pay for these screen readers. You'd think they put a bit more engineering into them. But this seems to be the reality. In WCAG 1, there's a requirement for layouts to make sense when linearized. Guideline 5.3, do not use tables for layout unless the table makes sense when linearized. Well, let's just disregard the tables for layout part because most of us don't have to deal with that anymore. Let's try to understand the linearization part. In other words, instead of the random visual access to the page, in other words, a sighted person with or without a disability could just look at the page and decide which thing they wanted to read at any given time based on a lot of heuristics that are poorly understood. This guideline wants us to make a page that works well when read serially from top to bottom without interruption. And because of the deficiencies of current screen readers, that's pretty much what you get when you use a CSS layout. It just sits there and reads the HTML source code order. So if you're trying to make a nice site for the sighted user and one that works okay for a screen reader user, what do you do? It all goes back to semantic HTML. Use the most semantic HTML you can. Even the Globe and Mail newspaper case, in the middle of these table tag soups, Craig has gone out of his way to put headings, lists, and other semantic elements into the page. That way, even if you're stuck listening to it from top to bottom, you can make use of some user agent tricks, some features of the screen reader to listen to just a list of headings on a page, for example. And we'll come back to that in a sec. try to put search at the top, since that's something that people need access to really fast. Who here doesn't put search at the top? Well, me. Okay, Andy Budd, anyone else? Everyone else, you put it right at the top because that's an important thing that people need, right? How about accessibility options? How many people's sites in the room actually have a link for accessibility options or information? About six. And that's all at the bottom, right? Right, because it's viewed as something rightly or wrongly. It's viewed as sort of legalese or additional information, like copyright, this sort of thing. Do I have that right? Well, it shouldn't be. That's got to go right at the top, because if you're sitting there listening to the page in serial access, you don't want that to be the last link. And question from Andy Budd. Yes, disagreement from Andy Budd.
No, it's not disagreement. I was just all wondering where access keys fit into this, because obviously you can have an access key set up for your accessibility statement.
Got a whole section on that later.
Okay.
Badly. As you know, the whole system doesn't work very well. Actually, I believe there's a recently developed site that does put accessibility right at the top, and they managed to make it graphically acceptable. I'm sure you are all familiar with the RNID.org, Royal National Institute for Deaf People. Trust me, RNID.org.uk had a complete standards compliant redesign by a company called InterResource, I believe. I don't think the developer's here at the moment. It's Tracy Godding we get from that. That's right. I blanked on her name. They did everything right. Tracy Godding's redesign, standards-compliant redesign of RNID, Royal National Institute for Deaf People, puts the accessibility options right up top, but it's in a sort of unobtrusive place. Also, although it has a sort of boxy and rectilinear design, that's simply a design choice they made, not necessarily a requirement of their code. They did user testing on that site where they wanted, and it turned out that all the users except the totally blind ones wanted a lot of images in color. And they used the highest degree of semantics possible, including on their e-commerce site. So they're, you can buy things from their store with valid semantic HTML, which you don't get very often. So have a look at their site. We can even bump up the fonts. So a skip navigation link, maybe that may or may not be necessary given that there's not a lot of navigation. And then accessibility right up there. And if I hadn't bumped up the font size, you probably wouldn't have noticed that. But if you were sitting there listening to it in a screen reader, it would be approximately the second thing you'd hear. Not exactly, because there are some other hidden things there. All right. Next topic, display and visibility. I expect that many of you will be familiar with the concept of display none in CSS. This is commonly viewed as a method to hide something from a visual user but hand it to a screen reader user. It is unfortunately unreliable because if your screen reader is having a really good day and it decides to interpret the CSS, because some of them do, some of them actually will attempt to interpret some kinds of CSS, although that tends to be mostly IBM homepage reader, it might actually pay attention to display none and heed the spec. The spec for display none means whatever is styled that way is expunged completely from the document. It is not manifested in any medium. So if you style something with display none, you are removing it from the document. It does not exist. This must be used with caution. This is a rather large club for rather delicate nails. It does not leave, if you use display none, it doesn't leave a hole the way visibility hidden does. Visibility hidden technically leaves a chunk in the layout the same size of what according to the size of what you've styled. Display none disappears completely. So this is not a reliable method to hide something from a visual user and deliver it to a screen reader user. So what do you do if you want to do that? Position it off screen. Are many of you familiar with the hack of taking your bit of content and moving it 1,000 or 99.99 pixels to the left of the screen, giving it a certain height and perhaps a different Z-index? Is that familiar to most of you? For whom is this an entirely new concept? Has anyone never heard of that before? Fellow in the back? Right. It's as simple as that. You use off-screen positioning to take the element or elements that you only want the screen reader user to hear, and you move them 1,000 or 2,000 or 9,000 pixels to the left of the screen, and use your CSS to collapse the height of the items that you just moved off the screen. They're still there in the source code, and they're still there in the CSS. They're just not visible to someone using a graphical browser. This is one of those hacks that we felt dirty using in the early days. But just in the month of August, there was research that came out from IBM where they have, on some of their pages, dynamically generated page contents. Whenever you load the page, it checks all the semantic HTML on the page, things like headings and so on, and makes ordered and unordered lists of all the items on the page with links, dynamically generates that, and positions it off-screen so that you, the screen reader user, the first five or six things you hear are the first five or six links on the screen, IBM, About Us, that sort of thing. And then you hear an entire list of everything else that's on the page that you can just zap to immediately. Dynamically generated, it changes every time you reload the page, and it's different for each page. But in their own development processes and in their own user testing, if memory serves, that method works well. It is a hack. There isn't a property in CSS called, hide-visual that you can use for this sort of thing. But it is the most viable option at this stage of the game. The question, though, is how many of those things do you need to move off the screen? I think the IBM approach is actually pretty good for a lot of their complicated pages because a lot of their products are complicated. A lot of things that they're dealing with are actually difficult. If it's the Yahoo login page, you probably don't need to hide anything. So you have to intelligently decide what to do about these things. Nonetheless, I wouldn't hide an accessibility link. I'd put that right up there. If, on the other hand, you have a very seriously graphically demanding client, if it's, for example, a packaged goods company and the packaging and the branding, hate that word, are very important things that they can't mess with, but they want to comply with the regulations, then you can position it off screen. But that would not be my preference. Always put it right there so people can hit it. Among other things, it does tell people that you care, right? It is an indication that you have taken concern for accessibility into account. But if you have to hide something, you can just zap it off screen. Questions thus far? Now we get into even more fun stuff. And a question from our friend Jeremy Keith.
I have a question about that IBM site you just mentioned. And it dynamically generates basically a table of contents from the document structure. So does that mean that screen readers will read things that are generated after the page has finished loading?
Oh, I believe they have a custom middleware application that intercepts the incoming page and reads the semantics from it, rewrites it, and then sends that to the client.
So it's server-side?
I believe so. I believe it is not a DOM implementation,
okay.
Which actually could be something for you to look at. In fact, someone jot this down. I'll put it in the speaking notes. We should look. I'll look that up. Perhaps even Jeremy can do that. We can figure out if it has to be server side or if it can be done in using DOM manipulation, which is essentially scripting, in a way that is actually compatible with existing adaptive technology. This is not a bad approach, and it's another one of those side effects of using document semantics. Once you set up a little system, it runs itself after that. All right. So that was a discussion of what you can do with CSS just to barely get by, right? Barely getting by doesn't cut the mustard these days. We want to do more than that. What can you use CSS for that actually enhances accessibility? I bet you a lot of people in this room know about Zoom layouts now. Who doesn't know about Zoom layouts? Don't worry. Oop, man over there. It wasn't my idea, but I've popularized it. It's the idea of using CSS to reorder your page. So I'll show you an example on Jill's machine in a sec. So you go from having what we're seeing here. By the way, I deliberately started a new tab with a blank screen so that you could see just how blinding an entire white page can be if you're not expecting it. So you go from having a multi-column layout of dark type on a blinding white background in small fonts that are hard to read, to having a single column layout with a dark background and light foreground type, with bigger fonts and things reordered and simplified so that it reads in a single column. What are you doing this for? You're doing this for the low vision or visually impaired person. We use a screen magnification software, often up to 16 or 32 times size. So your little fonts, this big, suddenly become that big. And if you take an ordinary page laid out through any method, table, CSS, or anything else, and you start blowing things up 8, 16, or 32 times, half the page disappears off the right side of the screen. And user testing has shown that people do not horizontally scroll to the right side of the screen. These low-vision users do not bother with that. First of all, they have a hard time finding the scroll bar. Then they have a hard time going back to where they were to try to figure out what they were looking for in the first place. So if you had anything on the right-hand side of the screen, it disappears. Even things at the higher magnifications that were just past the center line of the screen disappear. So using CSS, you can fix that, right? So it turns out that our dear friend Doug Bowman of stopdesign.com has at present the most advanced implementation of it. The scary thing about Doug is I was giving a presentation about this, and I walked off stage, and he was on his PowerBook, and he had a Zoom layout halfway done as I walked off the stage. If you ever need someone who has really good CSS knowledge, there is no better standards-compliant web designer than Doug Bowman down in San Francisco, so please feel free to hire him. So we go from Doug's beautiful multi-column design, which, scales pretty well, but eventually, even if you're using just the internal browser sizes, becomes unrealistic to read, to Zoom, probably with the inverted colors one. Here we go. And we'll pick the biggest possible fonts, of course. And suddenly, exactly the same content is now available in an easier-to-read form. And if I start bumping the font sizes up, it's actually viable to read. You can actually sit there and read that slowly, admittedly, but you can read it. And you don't lose anything. All of Doug's navigation is styled unordered lists. It's merely a question of changing the style on those. It breaks down when you get to bigger ones, turns into two lines, big deal. You just scroll down a bit. Scrolling down is no problem for the low vision user based on user testing. The only thing I don't like about this is that we don't have search at the top. But Doug explained that he has a problem with absolute positioning on that. So that's just a pragmatic limitation. How is this useful for a commercial site? It's tremendously useful for a commercial site because if you're trying to comply with the Disability Discrimination Act and everyone in your office thinks that that means getting things to work adequately on your 30-minute trial preview of JAWS, you can tell them, well, no, I can just borrow someone else's style sheet. In fact, you could just use Doug's style sheet, right, and change a few class and ID names and have an automatic page reformatter for my commercial site. So the low vision user who probably finds shopping in physical stores quite difficult because they can't read the labels and have a hard time navigating inside stores would actually be able to use your site and buy things. It's an easy and simple method using the same markup and two different style sheets to present the information in a customized way for the low vision person. We have some difficulties with this before we get to Andy. We have some difficulties with this. One is, how do you turn it on? Doug has this high design site for developers, and it took me a minute to save the settings. I had to find them and then save them. If you put a style sheet switcher at the top of your page, which is the obvious place to put it because it's a bit of accessibility information, your brand managers might want it sort of pushed off to the right so it's not really in the way of your corporate branding, but as we know, things on the right side of a screen tend to disappear for this group of people. The very group of people who need things not to be on the right-hand side of the screen, suddenly that's where you're putting the style sheet switcher. So it ends up that it seems the only viable place you can put it is the top left or the top center, or somewhere near the left, somewhere near the center, somewhere near the top of the page. And I don't know really of any site that does that. And I'm not entirely sure how to implement that on a commercial site. So we have a question from Ryan.
Yeah, I was curious. I bet probably a lot of us are going to have to convince managers to do these kind of things. And I was just curious, percentage-wise, how much time do you think it takes? It adds to the project to do a Zoom layout.
Well, In a case like this, fixing your style sheet is not complicated. If that takes you more than 2 hours, then you're probably using a really bad editor. The issue is, do you want to explain the concept of style sheet switching to your managers? Because if so, they might get a bit nervous. You're saying people can change the look of our site behind our backs through user style sheets, which no one uses? Or are you saying that you want us to invite people to change the look of our page? And the answer to that question is yes. Yes, we are saying that. If you want, you can limit that strictly to the Zoom layout concept, which is an accessibility provision for low vision users. You don't have to skin your site so there are five different ways of looking at it. Although for a video game site, that'd be perfect. The kids would love that, right? So the first discussion to have with them is, we're going to do this for accessibility. We're going to use this little bit of CSS. And if you think your client or your boss is a bit touchy about that, then just don't mention that you can use it for other things, right? Because then they might get upset. This, however, is all hypothetical. I don't know of any commercial sites that have ever put this sort of thing into effect. Some of you could be the first. And it could just be a small little thing. It could be, you know, only this small site for this little small client you have. Any kind of commercial site that uses a Zoom layout, I want to hear about, because then we can do user testing on it and see how well it works. An advantageous thing about the Zoom layout concept is it's all completely well-documented online now. In a short number of months, we've gone from having this concept, which is a wish list by a vision researcher down in New York called Aris Arditi, to having full-fledged prototypes with people's code that they openly invite you to use. So on the Ultimate Speaking Notes, I'll be linking to all those. There's a page on my site that has a lot of links on these things. And you can take it from there. You can view this as a kind of homework assignment to try to make any kind of commercial site, no matter how small, with a Zoom layout. And then we can do some user testing on that. Now, I've given you the best possible way to make type easier to read for a low-vision user. Well, what do you do about font size in general? Who here has to struggle with Internet Explorer and PX-based fonts? Nobody. Wow, that's amazing. Are you all familiar with the concept I just explained? Do you all know about the problem of Internet Explorer and PX-based fonts? Does that not ring a bell for anybody? That's amazing. That puts you in the top 0.01 percentile of developers. Well, so in that case, you all know about resizable fonts. You all know that the only reason to avoid PX as a font size is to get around the fact that Internet Explorer on Windows can't resize fonts in the PX unit, right? You also all know that PX is a relative unit, not an absolute unit. But in practice, you can't zoom them on Internet Explorer for Windows. All right? You know that making fonts bigger should be the browser's problem, right? Because that's a user agent issue. If we want to have CSS, we can have different presentations of pages, and that implies that our presentations can be nice. We can have nice graphic design. We can have good typography. This is all about making attractive web pages. The RNID case, for example, their user testing had all users of all kinds except the screen reader users demanding a visually attractive page, especially the deaf and hard of hearing users. They were adamant about that. So, of course, we want to have attractive websites, but they can also be accessible, right? So how do you deal with the font resizing issue? It should be up to the browser, but a lot of people, especially people who are new to the Internet or people who have really bad browsers like Internet Explorer for Windows, don't know that it's even possible. So for that, you have to roll your own font resizer. We're going to go back to the Globe and Mail page. Oh, don't you love this bit of marquee news tag text here? Yeah, Craig can't get rid of everything that he wants to. So we'll go back to the same story. Up on the right here, we have a little widget that clearly says text size, and it has bigger and bigger letters inside little document icons. This is a bit of JavaScript that my friend Craig hacked together. And I'm using this as an example of the limitations that you find in real-world sites. The fonts never really get unbelievably big. You can just compare that to the size of the headline. That's still not very big, and now I've selected the maximum possible size. And if you're displeased by that and you know about your browser, you can start zooming things, but then the layout actually starts breaking, and a lot of the ads will overlap the text. Not today, of course, because today it's having a good day. Oh, there we go. And there's just no way around that. So the issue here is you want to overcome people's unawareness of the features of their own browser, but you want to actually make it work in the real world. And this is the point where I say, does anyone know how to do that? Because this is an ongoing problem in font resizing. There's always something that's going to break as you make things bigger, because even in CSS, we have the concept of containers. We have the box model, right? Boxes cannot grow forever. If they could grow forever, we wouldn't need zoom layouts. And in this context, we're not talking about zoom layouts. We're just talking about making comfortable font sizes for people who have, who have really thick glasses, or elderly people with presbyopia, which I'm developing, that sort of thing. I'm going to poll the audience. This is, again, one of my weaknesses. Does anyone have a really good solution? Does anyone have a site where they think their font resizer works really well, even with other content like photos and ads? No? No. Does anyone have any clue how someday we could get one that really works well? No? Oh, Andy does.
Well, I was just going to say that rather than just resizing the fonts, it could also switch style sheets to subtly change the layout. So you go from a small font size that has three columns to a medium one that has two to the large one that has one. So it's kind of you could use a combination of font size resizing and also zoom layouts, I suppose.
Or doing the Cameron Adams / Dan Cederholm thing. On Cameron Adams down in Australia has a set of JavaScript that changes the layout of the page as you change the dimensions of the browser. So you can go from three layouts to three columns to two to one automatically as you resize the screen. And Dan Cederholm on his site has a way to switch from a fixed to a fluid layout just with one click of the mouse. So is the solution here when you're going from, say, the medium size to the large and extra large to actually alter the layout with CSS? I think Andy's onto something. I think that's a good case of uniting the existing knowledge. And as the presenter, I wish I'd thought of that before I came here. So credit Andy Budd with that. This is Andy Budd's idea of uniting these things. And in the Q&A this afternoon, maybe we can work on something like that. We can take, for example, one of your existing sites, if you wouldn't mind. We can put it up on the screen or just sit comfortably by your desk and look at it and try to see how we could adapt it to include that new technique. Unfortunately, I didn't have really good advice on this topic. It's just we have like these incomplete methods that, if we combine with Andy's new idea, might actually work. It is an ongoing problem, though, because I noticed the number of hands that went up. How many of you do have font resizers on your sites? Two, three, four. Good heavens! Has it occurred to the rest of you that they're necessary to put there? Several heads nod. What are the things that prevent you from putting them on your site? Is it the table-based layout problem?
Yeah, it's CMS.
Yeah, and the CMS won't let you. And another question from Andy.
One of the things that prevents me from using sort of font resizing widgets is just throwing another custom sort of preference interface at users.
I agree with that. However, there's another IBM research paper from last year that didn't state exactly but broadly implied that if you write out in words what the widgets are supposed to do, then people in their test cohort actually understood that, which is what Craig actually did here. He has the words text size and then these little icons. I'm not convinced it actually has to be utterly consistent. I just think it has to be understandable. And putting the words there are one way to do that. And, of course, we get to the same issue that your branding manager may not like that, but it might work, might be okay on sub-pages if not on the home page. Maybe the home page doesn't even need that kind of font resizing. All right. Yes, the fixed versus liquid thing. Why don't we look at Rammstein? Everyone's favorite operatic German heavy metal band, Rammstein, Rammstein, Rammstein.com. I insist that my heavy metal be German and operatic. I don't know about you. Now, Rammstein uses Cameron Adams' resize widget. Oh, look at that. It's a miracle, isn't it? So just by resizing the window, we go from a two-column layout, and the left column is really a nav bar, to a single-column layout, where the nav bar goes up top. And that's all done with a wee bit of JavaScript that Cameron Adams, who's only 22, down in Australia, came up with. There'll be a link to that on the ultimate slides. This is a brilliant usage of existing technologies, as far as I'm concerned. All the graphical browsers in common usage, even in uncommon usage, have enough JavaScript to do this. The number of people who have JavaScript turned off is very small, and often they're doing it for the wrong reasons. They think that that's the way to keep pop-up ads from appearing on their site or whatever, when in fact all they need to do is switch browsers. Or even if they have to use Internet Explorer on Windows, which is the main problem with this, they could use some variants of Internet Explorer on Windows by third parties that have this same feature built in. So it's my contention, radical though it may sound, that a lot of the people that have JavaScript turned off, who are a small number anyway, are doing it for the wrong reasons. If you're a person who requires this kind of accessibility, you shouldn't be turning JavaScript off. this is the sort of unobtrusive customization that we can use Jeremy Heath's DOM scripting to do. So if your question is one of fixed versus fluid layouts, well, you can have one or both or the other, depending on how you set your JavaScript and CSS up. This is an easy thing to do with Cameron's documentation. How many of you have not heard or seen of this, heard of or seen this before? Several. this is a really good and useful trick for your for a commercial site that needs to resize. Now, to finish up the topic of useful things that CSS can do for accessibility. all right, so we've seen Zoom layouts. We've seen Bowman's Zoom layout, actually. Why don't we go back to that? Because he has another kind. See if this works. There we go. What if you're not a low vision person? What if you're a person with a learning disability like dyslexia or any of the other learning disabilities that have an impact on reading? Your life on the web is sometimes very difficult because the web is essentially text. It's a reading medium. And when you're confronted with masses of dark text on a light background surrounded by flashing animated ads, as we saw on the commercial newspaper site, then it can be very difficult to read. There's some anecdotal evidence, but no user studies that I'm aware of, that show that some background colors, like very pale blue or very pale beige, are preferred by people with dyslexia and these other learning disabilities. Still black type, or the other kinds of colored type that you have on a page, but these slightly paler backgrounds. They also prefer less busy page designs, which doesn't have to be single column, it just needs to be fewer columns, and very often bigger type, but I suspect that's a question of having more line spacing, more letting between the lines, so that they have to deal with fewer words within their visual field. This can also be accommodated using exactly the same technology as a Zoom layout. It is another kind of Zoom layout, it's just with different color and font preferences. And of course, this brings up the difficulty of how do you make a selector for these sorts of things. I don't know. I would love to have some of the organizations in Britain that are trying to promote better web accessibility for people with learning disabilities to send me an email. We can set up some test pages and actually try this on a few users with dyslexia or other learning disabilities, because it could be an easy and simple thing to do to change colors and type to their preferences. How many people in the room are aware that there are adaptive technologies specifically made for people with learning disabilities? I think the lady in the back. Anyone know the word Kurzweil? The company known as Kurzweil, previously, founded by Raymond Kurzweil, one of the geniuses of the 20th century. In the early 80s, he developed a reading machine. You'd plunk any printed thing down on the glass and it would read it out loud. The big breakthrough there was not necessarily the speech output. His was the first really good, commercially viable, inexpensive, it was only $12,000, speech output. But the big thing was his scanner could read almost any font. He invented the capacity to read any font. He sold that to Xerox. Xerox still makes it. But he has there's still another company that he runs, Kurzweil Systems. And they have what are essentially screen readers for people with dyslexia and other learning disabilities, which can automatically invert colors on a web page, which has rather unpredictable results on typical sites, read things out in speech, and while it's reading the words out in speech, it highlights the words that it's speaking so that you can follow along. I've watched these things I've seen demos of them, I've used them myself. They're very different from blind people's screen readers like JAWS. First of all, they go way slower. They assume that you can see, and they assume that your needs are different. In a lot of them, you can stop on any word and get a definition, for example, right? So there are adaptive technologies that learning disabled people use. They're kind of a hack. The speech output can be beneficial for a lot of this group. They can still use that. But the things like inverting the colors of the screen, which doesn't work very well on a real site, we can take care of that as designers. We don't have a really good interface for it. That's why I want to do some tests. We can handle half of the problem. Oh, further on learning disabilities. The other Australians, Russ Weekly at Max Design, he works for a museum down in Australia. And he's come up with a method of using JavaScript to show and hide different degrees of content. Christian Heilman has another set of JavaScripts that do that sort of thing. If you're a person with a learning disability, you don't often, but not always, you don't like being confronted with huge gobs of text, right? So using these methods, you can have your same original content and only show part of it at a time Perhaps you only show the summary and skip all the boring parts if the user doesn't want them. Or you can just step through the document paragraphs at a time, which is a useful feature. There's a technique for that. We also don't have user testing on it. Does anyone have a site that has a lot of words on it, perhaps they're legally required, that is complicated to use? Maybe it's a form, some kind of an application form, like credit cards or store accounts, this sort of thing. Does anyone in the audience run a site like that? What I'm asking is, do you run a site that you find hard to use because there's too much text there? It's too hard to read, too many steps to go through. Is anyone unfortunate enough to be stuck with that sort of thing? Wow, you really are elite. Well, when you get that client, when you get that client, you can use the JavaScript to show and hide controls. And when we get to the forms discussion, which I'm really going to need your help on, trust me, we can talk about breaking up big forms into multiple short forms. Our next one is images, and that's several pages. So today we should probably take our break now. I could certainly use a cup of tea, but a fellow here has a question, I think.
This was just about source order. There are a couple of techniques for getting navigation, pulling it from the bottom of the page back up to the top. And I've used it on quite a few sites, but I had a comment from someone saying that this went against learned screen reader behavior. So for me, logically, I'd want main content first, then subcontent, then local navigation, then global navigation, because that's the order of importance for me. Mm-hmm. But the comment was that learned behavior states that main navigation is at the top, even though logically it should be at the bottom.
And people have just learned to sit there and listen to 20 or 30 links at the top.
Exactly. Any opinion on that?
I agree. I agree with both sides. I agree that your way is actually correct for serial reading of a page. And I also agree with the heuristics that the screen reader users have had to develop. They've had to hack their way through these sites. So why don't you just position off screen a link that skips to navigation as opposed to from it. It would be nice to have some user testing on that. I know a couple of people have tried that. By the way, you could just duplicate it. You can duplicate your navigation off screen. The Section 508 requirements in the United States state that you have to have a mechanism to skip repetitive bits of navigation. And some people interpret this narrowly, and they have, if there's footer navigation at the bottom of the screen, they'll have a skip link on the top of that. So you can skip the navigation at the bottom to reach the very end of the page. Okay, well, that's applying things a bit too literally. If we do it this way, we're also applying things literally. There'll be navigation at the bottom of the page, and you could just duplicate it off screen at the top. And in that case, the navigation at the bottom, you could just have a little thing that's also positioned off screen saying end of content or something, so that the end of content, additional navigation follows, this sort of thing. So if you're reading it serially in speech or braille, you would get the navigation up top. And at the end, if you wanted to listen to it again, you could. And if you didn't, you could stop. That's a technique, and I don't know if it works, but it quite possibly would. And that would satisfy everyone, right? Because the screen reader user is accustomed to bad sites. When confronted with this novel concept of a good one, would have behavior that they can adapt to, and you would still have all your main content at the top, really, in the visual presentation. Is that bogus, or is that I think it's an idea. Like, we should give it a whirl. You know what I mean? And Patrick has something to say, inevitably.
Just about the the text resizing widgets that we were talking about before. One of the reasons I never like to use or don't really feel comfortable using it is because it feels a bit to me like we as web developers need to kind of make up for the kind of missing functionality that the browsers don't implement or don't implement nicely.
And this is a case where I think we do. I think this is a usability issue that's so widespread, and browsers are so bad at making it clear that you can do this, and people sit there and struggle, especially elderly people who may not be people with disabilities, but they're still people. It is an easy thing for us to do. It's something pragmatically like dealing with embed, Feel a bit dirty about it and resent the browser manufacturers for not doing a better job. But do we want people to use our sites or not? Right?
Yeah.
And this is one of those cases where usability and accessibility intersect. I agree with you, but I'm willing to live with it. And the best part is when we start getting into the images section, then we'll really be sharing the secrets of web accessibility, because there's a lot of stuff that people don't know about that.